Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Folks, this is an important show. We are going to have a wide-ranging conversation with Mr. Lou Rockwell, who is the founder and CEO of the Ludwig von Mises Institute and LouRockwell.com. Welcome, Lou.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Glad to have you with us. We also have our special commentator, Ms. Zoe Russell, who is a 2009 graduate of Mises University. Hello, Zoe.
Hi, Michael.
So, folks, let me further introduce you to Lou Rockwell. Lou is one of the key people in the world today promoting freedom and peace. Lou was a Ludwig von Mises' own editor in the 1960s and later served as Congressman Ron Paul's chief of staff. He's a founder of the Auburn, Alabama-based Mises Institute, as I mentioned a minute ago, and the highly successful blog LouRockwell.com. Together, these entities are among the highest frequented and most influential free market internet sites in the entire world. So the working title that I have for this show today is pretty broad. It's the disastrous cost of government-forced health plans on businesses, how to cure unemployment quickly, and how we can stop the spread of tyranny. And, you know, Lou, we just actually today and the other day saw Congress violating the Constitution and passing this disastrous health care plan. This is going to have very wide-ranging effects. Please explain why mandating and forcing businesses to offer health insurance to workers is a bad idea and makes no sense.
Michael, I'll just mention that we've had many decades of increasing government intervention into the medical care market. Really, every president since Roosevelt has made things worse, and that's the Republicans as well as the Democrats. But this, what Obama has done is, I guess, the biggest deal since what Lyndon Johnson did with the passage of Medicare and Medicaid. So it's a huge step up. It means, except for those who can find physicians who take no third-party payments, that is either government or private, and simply deal with you on a fee-for-service basis, as medicine always was always true of medicine in the past, then we're all going to be forced into these HMO-style medical practices where I think of it as, maybe 2 minutes with a doctor, and he's going to give you seven prescriptions because this bill is backed by the pharmaceutical industry massively, by the hospital industry, by the insurance industry. So it's going to be good for these industries that are connected to the government. They're big donors to Obama, so they're going to do fine. American business is not going to do fine, and neither are individuals. So I think just if we look at things from, say, just an individual standpoint, we only have to think of what anything, all government medicine is like. I mean, we can look at, say, the veterans hospitals, and if people have not been to a veterans hospital, I highly recommend it. First of all, the guys there can use your visit, but it's very interesting to see these Soviet-style entities in what we think of as a free country, and that's, of course, where they'd like us all, or the Indian Health Service hospitals in Oklahoma is where I've been to see them, but they're in other states as well, the public health service hospitals. All these socialist institutions of the federal government are pretty grim if you're a patient and not too hot if you're a doctor either. But what Obama's going to do is, yes, he's going to mandate that everybody has to buy so-called insurance. And tell me keep me apprised of our deadline here. But I might just add to this: none of this is insurance. This all was a trick. Franklin Roosevelt picked it up from the Germans in the late 19th century. They started it. So calling Social Security insurance, then later calling Medicare and other medical programs, and now this thing, insurance is not insurance. Insurance is, say,
is something else, and we're going to have to pick that up right after the break because we're coming into the end of this particular segment. But please stay with us, folks. This is Radio Free Market. We have Lou Rockwell with us, and we're talking about the effects of this health care plan on Americans today. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. And we're back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and we're talking to Mr. Lou Rockwell. And we were just talking for just before the break, Lou, you were talking about how this new passage is not health insurance. It's really not insurance at all.
No, and none of Medicare is not insurance. Social Security is not insurance. First of all, of course, they're mandatory. So if something's mandatory, it's not a market institution. But what happens with insurance is actuaries are able to look at a class. They're able to look at, say, a certain type of house in a certain city. And from experience, and these are tremendous analysts, they're able to tell that a certain percentage of those houses are going to burn down every year.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they can sell insurance based on that knowledge. They can know that a certain percentage of otherwise healthy 60-year-old men are going to have a heart attack and die over the next year. So they can sell insurance and make a profit, but that's, you know, you can't. It's not insurance if you have any control over it.
The basic concept of insurance is these things that are beyond your control.
Well, if you burn down your own house, you know, that's a criminal act. So they can't insure against that. But medical care, you're in some sense in control of it. You can go to the emergency room as many times as you want if you're a welfare patient. You can, you know, you're in control of your health to some extent. Ludwig von Mises, in his great book Socialism, written in 1922, talks about how socialized medicine diminishes what he calls the will to health. Because just as the existence of unemployment insurance makes people just on the margin less concerned about keeping a job because they figure, well, I've got that payment coming for a year, just as people are on the margin less concerned with saving for their retirement, this has, of course, had a horrific societal and economic effect, Social Security, because they figure they're going to get Social Security, the government's going to take care of them. Well, if there's socialized medicine, then people will take less good care of themselves because they figure, you know, somebody else is going to pick up the tab. This is not good. It's not good for the individual, not good for society. It's not good for the economy. It's very, very bad. And so what Obama has done is taken a bad situation. We already have a probably half state, half private medical system, and he's going to drastically take it in the direction of greater statism. So this is very tough on business. He's nationalizing a big piece of the economy. He's putting on massive taxes. It's, of course, vast amount of spending. Vastly, you can't even believe that he's putting us even more into debt, but he is. So this thing is a total disaster. And what about the fact also, just from a sort of civil liberty standpoint, that as Ron Paul points out, in this bill is the hiring of 16,500 additional IRS agents, that's 16,500 additional tax police, to enforce the health care plan. Now, I must say I don't exactly know what that means, but it doesn't sound good.
Well, absolutely. I mean, people think, as one congressman said in that particular report, that when most people think of health care reform, they think more of doctor's exams, not more IRS exams. But we're going to see a lot more IRS exams, particularly for small businesses.
Yes, and so, of course, the government wants – we always have to remember the government would like total control. Every government would like to be a totalitarian state if it could get away with it. So whenever, for example, after 9/11, when people's resistance to a police state diminished, the government vastly expanded in that direction. People are worried about health care matters, so they're expanding here too.
You know, a lot of the people that are listening to our show are I would say, somewhat new to to a lot of the concepts that we present. And one of the great things that you've done in many of your writings that I advise the listeners to at lourockwell.com and go under his Lou's archives and pick out some of his essays. They're fantastic to read. One in particular that I really liked is just exactly what you were just talking about. Government creates human suffering, and in there you break down this how employers are directly affected and how they have to pass these costs that they incur on to their employees in the form of lower wages or lower employment and so on like that, because the costs cannot purely be absorbed by employers. They must be passed on.
Well, it's right, and it's difficult to. I just want to mention it's difficult to pass some things on because, after all, in terms of, say, prices, every businessman is charging as much as he can, consistent with the highest profit, or at least that's what he's attempting to do. Mm-hmm. So if the government puts huge more taxes on him, mandates that he offer these various government schemes, so-called health insurance to his employees, it's going to diminish his profit and it's going to diminish the productivity of the business. He can't just pass it on.
Right.
So, you're exactly right. Employees earn less and have less secure jobs because of the mandates of the federal government.
And fewer people will be hired in the first place. So there's always this element of what we don't see. And because we don't see these people that would not be hired because the employer is not going to expand their business if they know that they're going to have to carry these additional costs. You know, people forget this basic principle that employers are actually consumers of labor, and they have the same motivations as all consumers.
Well, they want the best product for the best price.
Sure, sure.
When did
so that means
that start covering the health care altogether? Why did it even start with employers? Why wouldn't it just be the employees?
You know, that is a great question, and it happened during World War II. And back in those days, the income tax brackets went up to 93%.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you had a very productive employee in your company and you wanted to compensate them to prevent them from going someplace else, it didn't make sense to pay them above a certain amount. And by the way, that 93% came in at a relatively low level. So what companies came up with was ways to give their employees non-tax compensation. So this is when the whole idea of companies supplied health insurance, so-called, began. And it made no sense whatsoever, except with these 93% tax rates.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry, Zoe, what did you say?
It just stuck.
Yeah, and it just stuck, exactly. Well, eventually the IRS started claiming, hey, this is actually income. And so then the whole process began of employers getting this as a tax deduction, and everyone started taking it for granted that this was going to come, that was part of the employment package.
As an individual, you used to be able to deduct on your income tax your health insurance premiums, but Reagan ended that.
Mm-hmm.
The alleged free market guy, Ronald Reagan.
Right, exactly. So, you know, it's very obvious that the actions that were taken in the last few days are really going to make this recession worse. Please, if you would, explain why the price of labor must fall.
Well, you know, because the government is mandating all these additional costs, so it's and they're talking about raising the minimum wage, which is disastrous. All the high payroll taxes, all the lawsuits that if an employer decides to fire an employee, it's not sometimes easy. That's becoming more and more difficult. That's actually the sort of a union and government goal, is to make it almost impossible to fire anybody, which of course has a very bad effect. But if we look at something like the Social Security tax, anything that is mandated, the total amount the employer pays for you that's what you should be getting as salary. But a lot of it is going to Social Security, it's going to payroll taxes, it's going to all kinds of state unemployment taxes and injury taxes and so forth. So, yeah, we all make much less money than we would in the absence of all these controls by the government.
Well, you know, Austrian economics does not rely on empirical studies, but from logic for its strength. But as you pointed out in your recent article, Richard Vedder and Lowell Galloway spent years accumulating evidence of the link between full employment and lower labor costs on the one hand and higher labor costs and unemployment on the other. What did they find out?
Well, they looked at the Great Depression specifically to see why did unemployment go to 25%. And by the way, because Clinton and others have finagled with the way the Bureau of Labor Statistics determines that figure, probably our actual unemployment right now, if as compared to the 25% during the Great Depression, is in the upper teens. It's not 10% or 9.8%. But what they discovered is that, you know, the government deliberately sought to raise wages during, as a crazy Hoover-Roosevelt policy, on the idea that the government could just sort of order you to be paid more. But what that meant was, just like the minimum wage, it outlawed employment, except under certain conditions. And because they were able to keep the wages up and minimum wage laws and that sort of thing, we had just, as you mentioned before, horrific human suffering. So there's a lot of suffering right now, and the government is really engineering a whole lot more suffering. You know, we're in this recession. Maybe it's a depression. They keep talking about a recovery, but I must say I don't see it. I mean, they may be doing fine on Wall Street, but that's all.
There are certain sectors. Now, we're not going to have time to really develop this question, so we're going to only get it started before we have to take another break. But this is so obvious. Why is this so mystifying to Congress and the Obama administration as they keep trying to pretend that reality doesn't exist?
Well, you know, that's exactly right. They do try to pretend that reality doesn't exist. But, you know, they're actually, I would argue, maybe not well-intended. The things they're doing are very much in the interest of themselves as the government, makes them more powerful, gives them more to control, and also more money to reward the special interests that put them in power and keep them in power. So things that, you know, it doesn't make sense for the country as a whole, but they don't care. It's good for them and for their friends.
Passing it forward. All right, folks. Well, we're going to have to take another break. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm Michael McKay, and I'm talking with Mr. Lou Rockwell, and we're going to come back in just a minute, so please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your host, Michael McKay, and with me is our very special guest, Mr. Lou Rockwell, and our special commentator, Ms. Zoe Russell. So, Lou, you know, I'm homeschooling my 15-year-old daughter, and we have been introduced. It's been a wonderful experience, and we've been introducing her to many of the concepts of Austrian economics. And one of the first lessons that we covered some years ago when we started this was somebody always pays, or as the acronym TANSTOFL, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch. You know, what is the social cost of overpricing labor relative to what the market would bear?
Well, you know, Michael, I might just say that's, of course, such a great point to be making to your daughter, because if you were to listen to the media right now and only learn from the media and learn from what the Obama administration is saying, you'd think that the government has like a huge pot of dough that they can hand out. Nobody has to pay for it. It's just sort of there, and it's just a matter of who gets it. You know,
the magic
they
money
never
tree.
Point out that the government has no money of its own. It can either take it by force, i.e. taxes, it can borrow it, which has other bad effects, or it can print it, which the Federal Reserve does.
Or they can steal it from
disasters.
Other, via conquering other nations.
Well, that's, they can loot, you're exactly right, they can loot other nations as well as us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that's, you know, that's the nature of government. It's somebody indeed does have to pay, but if any of us have ever been unemployed or know people who have been unemployed, it can be life destroying. I mean, it can be family destroying. It's people can lose everything, lose a lifetime of the results of a lifetime of hard work. So it's just horrific. I mean, these are not just statistics. These are real human beings who are being stepped on by the government. And the reason is, we could actually go from whatever is the actual unemployment rate today, 17%, 18%, 19%, to 0%, like overnight. Now, it wouldn't quite be overnight, but almost overnight. We could actually get rid of all unemployment if the government would get out of the labor market. So it's all
this is one of your great essays. I'm going to interrupt you here because I want everyone to please write this down. Lou has written this wonderful essay. It's How to Fix the Jobs Problem. And this is one of the key things that you make, this point that you make, that all this talk of unemployment is preposterous. And, you know, please expand on that.
And by the way, there was no unemployment in human civilization before unions and welfare states started. There was no such thing as unemployment in earlier centuries because there wasn't artificial impositions against being able to work and earn a living. So, but today the government's got so many different things it does to create unemployment. I mean, whether it's the minimum wage, which, as Thomas Sowell always points out, cuts off the bottom part of the ladder for people who, young people and so forth, who need a start. You know, all the high payroll taxes that just the amount of resources any employer has to expend keeping track of all this stuff, it's a huge cost. All the laws that, you know, threaten you if you fire an employee because you don't think that the employee should be able to leave when they want to leave, absent a contract, and you should be able to fire them if you don't feel they're doing the job. But there are all kinds of laws that make that very scary and difficult for the employer. And then there's all the, just all the other considerations that an employer has to take into account besides, can this person do the job? Is this the best person I can get for the job? You have to consider all kinds of demographic and other questions the government wants you to consider that have nothing to do with whether this person can do the job. And then there's the unemployment subsidy, which creates higher unemployment. I remember when George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, was complaining about, in his recession, about unemployment, and he dramatically lengthened and increased the amount of unemployment payments, and then we're shocked to see unemployment went up. Well, you know, it's a basic principle. When you subsidize something, you get more of it. So unemployment insurance subsidizes non-work, and therefore we get more non-work and less employment. It's very difficult to start a new business because of all the various taxes and mandates. There's all the withholding taxes that can harm both employers and employees. And if you're an independent contractor, they take up more than half your income, or at least close to half your income, which strikes me as immoral. I mean, that's, you know, even if one thought that taxes were legitimate, taking half of somebody's income for the people in Washington continue to live in the style to which they've become accustomed, it seems to me a significant problem. And then all the labor union laws that enable labor unions to force their will onto employers and employees. Maybe Obama's going to make this one worse with the so-called card check law and make it easier for unions, which enforce their will by violence. I mean, they think nothing of beating up so-called scabs, that is, people who, when they leave their jobs, would like to have those jobs, need those jobs, but they feel free to be able to beat them up and do worse things to them. And it's never, the cops never interfere because the unions always have a sort of blessing from the government. So to harm people for its own benefit, for the benefit of special interests like labor unions, and crushing the faces of poor people into the dirt with their boot. I mean, that's what they're doing, and it's a disgusting and rotten thing.
Yes, well, you know, this article that I just referenced, How to Fix the Jobs Problem, that you wrote, you not only list the various barriers and give an excellent explanation of each and every one of them, but you also then bridge to the next topic, which is, you know, why the other objection that happens to this is that it's not just jobs that people want, but they want good paying jobs. And now they're not all often willing to take the labor that is available to them. Now, unfortunately, I'm going to have to interrupt myself and not let you answer that question because we have to take another break. But we will be back right in a couple of minutes, folks. So this is Radio Free Market, and please stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, and with me is Mr. Lou Rockwell, and we're talking about, at this particular moment, jobs. And we were just talking about the resistance that people have to any job, any free market attempts toward improving the job situation, because they want good-paying jobs. And that is a limiting factor in the public's mind. Would you comment on that, Lou?
Well, it's true, and people think that if we remove these interventions, that everybody would be forced to work for 10 cents an hour or whatever. But you only have to stop to think for just a second that in the current system, if business had that sort of power, then how come we're not all working for the minimum wage? It would be perfectly legal for every single person in America to be paid the minimum wage. Well, there's a reason that even though businessmen would like to get the cheapest, best employees they can get, there's such a thing as competition. So they can't just offer you a dime an hour if there were no minimum wage. They have to compete with all the other businesses that might want to hire you. So But again, you know, you mentioned good-paying jobs. We all want good-paying jobs. But the government can't just mandate that. You know, we talked about the minimum wage. If the government wanted to say, if the government actually could make everybody rich, why don't they set the minimum wage at, say, $1,000 an hour? Hey, we'd all be living it up. But of course, if they did that, we'd all be unemployed, or everybody except people
and
in Hollywood.
The reality is that in a market-based labor contract, there really is no exploitation. You know, could you explain that?
Well, this is a Marxist concept of exploitation, which he believed employing somebody to do a job, to Karl Marx, was exploitation. And he believed that if you had communism, you would abolish exploitation. Well, of course, not quite. You had real exploitation. And the great Austrian economist Bill Hutt said we should think of exploitation as the use of violence or the threat of violence in an employment situation, the way unions do it, by the way, the way everything was in the Soviet Union, the way some things are here. That is actual exploitation. So there is exploitation. So if we would get the government out of the labor market, there would be no exploitation in the sense of hurting somebody or making them do things they don't want to do.
So there is no involuntary unemployment in a free market, because there's always work to be done in this world. And as you say, it is all a matter of making the deal. And this can only be done if the government just gets out of the way.
And the government has not raised people's income. Now, it's true that union guys can get more under the current system than they might get in a free market. People like, say, public school teachers get a whole lot more. Any government bureaucrats get a lot more. But those of us in the private sector, in the voluntary sector, all our incomes are dramatically lower because of all the things the government does, whether it's Social Security or all the interventions that have been going on for so long and stepped up, especially with the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt, and then the Great Society under Johnson and the horrible period we've had of high inflation and high welfare statism warfare statism under George W. Bush and now Barack H. Obama.
Okay. You know, what we're really zeroing in on is a conversation about the price system. And I love talking about the price system, because the price system is the choice system. And people have heard us talk about before on this show that the miracle of prices, you know, brings us to the discussion of the miracle of choices. You know, please explain, if you would, how this miracle of prices and the price system really brings the miracle of choices to everybody.
Well, you know, I like hearing you say the word miracle. Reminds me of the great Leonard Reed, always referred to the price system as the miracle of the market, because it does seem like a miracle. You have billions, maybe trillions of choices being made every day by people over this whole earth in buying and selling or not buying and selling, attempting to make their lives better, take care of their families, be able to give charitable donations or whatever else they might want to do, have a vacation. So it's rather than having, I mean, that we actually have two choices in this world. Either you can have a central planning agency like the old GOSS plan under the Soviet Union, or what I'm afraid the American government is becoming more and more like, where things are ordered, where you get an order and they put a gun to your head, in effect, and they say, do it or we're going to put you in jail or kill you. Remember, the government is that institution which claims the right to kill you if you sufficiently resist paying your parking ticket.
Right.
So that's their attitude. But the price system is entirely voluntary, and it's not planned by anyone. Again, it's billions of people making trillions of decisions, and all to the good, and raising standards of living, getting us out of poverty to the extent that is possible for the market, despite all the government interventions. Now, we're far poorer. All of us in the whole world are far poorer than we would be if it weren't for governments. But nevertheless, to the extent that we're able to not just be primitive cave people digging in the dirt with a stick and trying to plant a little seed, to the extent we don't live like that, It's entirely due to the freedom of the price system, and
the price
and
system
and
really
private
comes
property, because you've got to have private property to have a real price system.
Right.
As Mises pointed out, that's what the trouble with socialism is.
Right.
There is no private property in the means of production. So you have to have private property. But based on private property, this miracle of the market gives us everything we eat, gives us our houses, our clothes, our futures, and that's civilization. And the government is the enemy, unfortunately, of civilization.
Yeah. You know, the central planners definitely try to limit these choices. One of my favorite stories that we have told here on Radio Free Market a couple of times, because we've had Dr. Yuri Maltsev on this show many times, is Yuri tells a story about after he had defected from the Soviet Union in the early 1990s, when his former boss, who was then working for the Russian government, came over to the United States and was in Washington, and they decided to spend an evening together, and they went to a liquor store, and his former boss went to a display and got a six-pack of O'Doul's, a non-alcoholic beer, and put it up on the counter. And Yuri ran over and said, no, you don't want that. This is a non-alcoholic beer. And his boss said, oh, that's ridiculous. Who would make such a thing? And Yuri said, no, yes, this is exactly non-alcoholic beer. You don't want to have it. And this boss said to Yuri, who would approve the production of such a thing? And that story gets right at the heart of this entire process of central control. It is equivalent to the removal of choices. And that's exactly the kind of thing that we're facing the more government mandates these fewer options to us.
And as Dr. Bill Peterson, who was a colleague of Mises's at New York University, always points out, this is sort of the democracy of the marketplace. He would argue that democracy is not so hot politically because of what it's led to. But in the marketplace, sort of everybody's got to vote, and that's everybody in the world has got to vote to the extent we have free trade and are able to have dealings in nations and among nations.
And yet,
to the extent that's free, we benefit.
And yet, as the Congress and the President creates yet another crisis, they stand to be able to take advantage of, the thought comes, why won't it work to just throw the current crop of bums out?
Well, I think it's a good thing to throw the current crop of bums out. The only trouble is there's another crop of bums who come in. So,
even have more clout behind them.
Well, yeah, especially because they'll have the mandate. But when I hear the Republicans talking about repealing this bill, it's just, the Republicans have never repealed anything, ever, in their entire history. They've never repealed anything. So at least the Democrats got rid of prohibition. So the Republicans keep expanding everything. And when the Democrats get in, they want to keep all this stuff in existence because they want the contracts. They want the river of payoffs that come about through these government interventions to their party and their people, and they want to put their people in charge. So neither one of these parties the Republicans may talk limited government, but of course it's not true. We just have to think about what George W. Bush was like, although I'll admit that Obama's worse, but Roger Garrison, great Austrian economist Roger Garrison, once pointed out that sooner or later every president makes you nostalgic for his predecessor. And I never thought I'd miss George W. Bush, but now I do. And I missed Clinton, of course, when Bush was in.
Well, that's very funny. Well, let me ask you, what do you think of the states challenging federal authority on strictly internal matters such as, their environmental laws, land use, medical marijuana, et cetera?
Gosh, I think this is one of the most encouraging developments that's happening in our country. We have, for the first time in many, many years, an increase in the constitutional principles of nullification, for example, and interposition, and even secession. So Thomas Jefferson, Dr. Tom Woods, by the way, has a great book coming out at the end of June called Nullification, and it's about this, the history and the reason for this concept. But the fact that people are realizing that you actually just don't have to you don't have to lie down and let the feds roll over you. There are ways that you can say no, because every government has to ultimately depend on the consent of the governed. And if they don't have that consent, then they can't do anything. And that partly has a reason, partly has to do with the fact that the group of people living off the majority is of necessity a minority, and then they live off the majority. I want to recommend Murray Rothbard's great introduction to The Politics of Obedience, and you can find that on the Mises site.
Oh, I've read this book by Labouetti.
By Labouetti, a lawyer.
Yeah, it's a fantastic
French
book.
Lawyer.
Yeah,
maybe the first great libertarian work ever.
Yes, I think it's absolutely spectacular work that most people have never heard of this gentleman, and Murray's fabulous introduction to it is truly inspiring. The Politics of Obedience, why people basically take it. Why do we take this?
Well, De Labouetti said in Political Science, he's writing in the 16th century, he said that the people who study politics, they always want to figure out how can we make sure that people obey? How can we make sure that nobody disobeys? But he said to him the question was, why the heck does anybody obey?
Right.
Why do some guy sets himself up as king, and he says, I want some of your property. Why do people go, I want your life to fight my war and so forth. How come they obey? He said this is to him the great mystery of politics.
Right.
And so his book is a short book, easy to read, very well written, wonderful translation, and as you say, the Rothbard intro just brilliant. So it's a great work of libertarian political philosophy.
I think it's probably one of the most paradigm shifting things that anyone can read in less than an hour. It is The Politics of Obedience. It's available at Mises.org. That's Mises.org, and you'll find it under the literature section. And I highly recommend to everyone that they go and read that absolutely excellent essay. Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. Thank you for bringing that up. Greatly appreciate that. Well, do you see the future of America with the development of more and more states asserting their local sovereignty or their local rights?
Well, there's a crisis coming, and I think with the crisis, we're already seeing an indication of it, and it's the result of huge amounts of intervention, huge amounts of taxation, meddling with our lives for a long period. But it started back during the whole Tea Party business. Actually, I would argue it started with the Ron Paul presidential campaign, when he called forth millions of young people who all of a sudden, thanks to Austrian economics and thanks to Ron Paul, were thinking, well, wait a minute, the Federal Reserve is ripping us off. You know, we don't need an institution like that. In fact, we don't need to be an empire with bases in 700 places all over the world and in virtually every country trying to control other countries at vast cost to the average American taxpayer. We don't actually have to have this regime. And, again, people are exploring things in American history, and Thomas Jefferson's and James Madison's great Virginia and Kentucky resolves of 1798, where they argued that if the federal government is trying to pass some unconstitutional legislation, the states have the perfect right to say, hey, wait a minute, not in my state, not in our state. You're not going to bring that in here because it's unconstitutional. And we've unfortunately been brainwashed into the notion that only the Supreme Court can somehow declare things constitutional or not. But the original view was that the states had that power, the Congress had that power, that all different sectors of society could in effect say that. So if the state of Texas says they don't want that health care plan, I think it's very, very interesting that we hear talk about nullification and other what people might think of as antique principles from the 18th century. But I think they're alive and hot. The government doesn't like them. The regime doesn't like them. They try to smear it. But I think it's very, very encouraging. And how this is all eventuate, who knows. But it's not correct to think that all is lost by any means. There's a huge amount of interest by Americans in real economics, in real history, and in resisting the federal government. If we remember back to right after 9/11, it seemed like there were seven of us who were concerned about what was going on in Washington. Now there's just vast numbers. And I think it's very, very, I'm very encouraged. And again,
well,
by all this talk of
nullification. That's very good to hear. That's very good to hear. I'm glad to hear that that you're feeling very encouraged about that, because I know that when you're standing up for freedom, often it feels like a pretty lonely place. And, you know, I also want to spend this moment just to plug our own show here, Radio Free Market. And please, folks, go to the archives. On March 20th, 2010, I did an interview with Dr. Yuri Maltsev on this topic of nullification, secession, interposition, in relationship to how it contributed to the collapse of the Soviet Empire. But interwoven in that was some of this information about American history as well. This is a topic that everyone needs to get some background on. Unfortunately, it's completely not taught in our school system, and I think everyone should really take the time to start to learn about that. And I also am looking forward to Tom Woods' new book on nullification that will be coming out in a couple of months. So we're going to be coming up on a break, but before we do, I want to take this opportunity to start to plug the Mises Institute, for which you, Lou, are the CEO and founder of. The Mises Institute is the at the vanguard of Austrian economics, which we here at Radio Free Market often refer to as reality economics, which is important because reality is not optional. And we're going to talk more about that in our final segment, which is about to happen in a couple of minutes, right after we finish this next break. So please stay with us. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm your host, Michael McKay, talking with Lou Rockwell, and we'll be back in just a second. Thank you for listening. Welcome back, everyone. This is Radio Free Market, and I'm going to turn it over to our special commentator, Zoe Russell, who we were talking about this topic of the Mises Institute during the break. Please, Zoe, go ahead.
Well, right. I went to Mises University in 2009, and I was actually an economics major from college. And when I graduated, I thought, what do you do after I graduated, which was late planning, I thought, what do you do with an econ major? What do you do when you dislike, let's say, hate the government? Where do you go with an economics major? Well, this is the place to go with your econ major if you're somewhat different. And believe me, you will meet extremely intelligent people in their grad programs. You can learn about which universities are friendly to Austrian economics. You can figure out ways. You don't necessarily have to go back to school to enjoy something like the Mises University. It'll basically give you a wonderful starting point, introduction into Austrian economics, and let you have this major network. They send out an email list. You have a huge network of people that now you know have the same mindset of you, as you. And you can see where they're taking their careers and what they've learned and where they're going with economics. So I just had a wonderful time.
That's great. So, Lou, talk about some of these programs that the Mises Institute has developed for helping people, just average people, apply Austrian economics, what, again, we like to call reality economics, to their practical lives. Because this really is about making your life more productive and living in a more peaceful, cooperative society.
Well, I'll just mention, first of all, the Mises University program that Zoe attended has been going on for, I guess, about 26 years. And we've had a huge number of very smart kids from all over the world, not only from the United States. And it's just an extraordinary group, many of them now teaching, others in business like Zoe, some of them practicing law. Some of them are history professors, but it's all... they continue to be involved in the fight for liberty, whatever their career path is. And I think that week at the Mises University in the summer here at in Auburn, kids tell me it was the best thing in their whole educational career. That one week they learned more there than they did in 4 years of college. We have, as Zoe said, we have graduate students as well as undergraduates, even an occasional high school student, although that's pretty rare. So the Mises Institute is about teaching the truths of, as you say, reality economics, Austrian economics, and of classical liberalism and libertarianism, that is the freedom philosophy. So we have the Mises University. We have graduate students who come and spend the whole summer with us. and in directed research and producing papers. We have people who sometimes come and do their doctoral work with us, spend a year after they finish their coursework and do their dissertation here. We have programs for non-economists. We have professional programs for economists. We just finished the big Austrian Scholars Conference, Michael, that we were very glad to have you there just recently. So we have all kinds of physical programs. We have a wonderful library here in Auburn, a great library of Austrian economics and classical liberalism, full of books that are available nowhere else, except in maybe the Library of Congress or the very, very big libraries. But we also put out publications. We put out academic journals, many, many books, hundreds and hundreds of books in Austrian economics and classical liberalism and libertarianism.
And I would say I'm going to interrupt you here, Lou, because we are into our last minute and we are going to have to break. But people, everyone should go to Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. Sign up for the daily reports. They are just phenomenal. You will learn so much just by getting this daily information. So I want to thank you, Mr. Lou Rockwell and Zoe Russell, for being with us today. This is Michael McKay and Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can download this and all of our shows for free. And until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.